Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, Stackwaddy Game, are you going first?
All right, I'll go first. And I think we ought to thank, actually, our listener, Baden Smith, who the other week we were talking about Stackwaddy Game. We were saying, have we done this before? We can't remember. And Baden Smith, bless him, went back, Dave, didn't he, and listened to all of them. And we have done, well, we now know, actually, because he made a list of all the ones we've done so far, all the topics. We've done 86 so far.
Oh, God,
I know. This is the 87th coming up. Amazing.
I guess it's for the benefit of people who've only caught on to it recently, I think, if I remember correctly, it began with us airily making jokes about Stackwaddy, anonymous rock band of the early 70s. And somebody got in touch and said, there can't really be a group called Stackwaddy, can there? And therefore, that's how it began. You know, the idea is that are these names real? Or are they Memorex? That was the idea.
Exactly. One of them is fictitious. And actually, it's kind of expanded a bit since then.
It has, yes.
And I've gone into this different format. I'll give you one now. Okay. Reggae sound systems, right?
Oh.
Especially Jamaican ones.
Right.
Tend to have epic, cartoonish, slightly apocalyptic names.
Right.
So I give you famous reggae sound system or Marvel Comics superhero. Okay? All right. The first one is Silverhawk. Sound system or superhero? Silverhawk.
Superhero.
It's a sound system. Veteran producers Cleavey and Steely, they beat Bodyguard in the Guinness Sound of Greatness Sound Clash when relaunched in October 2011. Just telling you. Just saying. Okay, second one, Night Nurse.
That's a Gregory Isaacs tune, isn't it? But it can't be a superhero. That's got to be a sound system.
No, it is a Gregory Isaacs tune. But it is actually a superhero. Linda Carter takes on the moniker Night Nurse in order to help and heal and patch up the superheroes in need. I know. Okay, Black Widow.
Oh, superhero.
Yep, and super spy Natasha Romanoff. One of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s most deadly assassins and a frequent member of the Avengers. You know this stuff. I don't have to tell you that. Doctor Strange. No, sorry. Downbeat the Ruler.
Downbeat the Ruler. Sound system.
Downbeat the Ruler is indeed a sound system from New York, operated by Tony Screw. It features Brigadier Jerry, Josie Wales and Rankin Joe. Doctor Strange.
Superhero.
Yep, Sorcerer Supreme, the primary protector of Earth against the magical and mystical threats. There we go. Aftershock.
Got to be a sound system.
No, it's two female villains inheriting their powers from different versions of their father, Electro. All right, Tom the Great Sebastian. Superhero or sound system?
Sound system.
Yep. Started in 1950. Brilliant. It's a brilliant name, that. Tom the Great Sebastian. Named after a trapeze performer in the Barnum and Bailey Circus. Tony Matterhorn. That's a great name. Tony Matterhorn.
Tony Matterhorn. Is that a superhero?
Which do you think?
Superhero.
No, he's a dancehall DJ called Dufton Taylor, the man from Mars. Two more. Battle Axe.
Oh, good grief. Superhero.
Yep. Yeah, she's an unlimited class wrestler who carries an axe as her weapon of choice. And you might have guessed that, of course. An emperor.
What was that?
Emperor Faith.
Emperor Faith. Sound system.
Yeah, it was. It was run by, it's from Kingston in the 70s, run by Mikey Faith, who is Bob Marley's accountant. That's an interesting job. Bob Marley's accountant. As our old production editor at Smash Hits used to say, I smell cooking. There we go, Dave. That's very good. I don't know whether you won or you didn't win. I think you won, probably. Very good.
I'm going to counter with, I want you to picture this, okay? I want you to picture an American cityscape from the 40s or the 50s, okay? You're on the outskirts of an industrial town. In the far in the background, you can see the smoke rising from the chemical plant, okay? And coming down a road, rutted road towards you, is a beaten-up old Cadillac going through the potholes in the road, heading towards a small house in the foreground, okay? And the man gets out of the car, and as he looks up at the house, a shapely female figure emerges from the door to the sound of a frowsy saxophone, and he can see her outline through the screen door, and a single shot rings out, because we're in the world of American film noir, okay, Mark?
Oh, this is good.
And so you have to decide whether these titles are classic American film noir or lesser-known Bruce Springsteen songs.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Which of the two? Okay, here we go. Here's the first one.
Yep.
They drive by night.
That's a film noir.
It is. When one of two truck driving brothers loses an arm, they both join a transport company where later one of them is falsely charged as an accessory in the murder of the owner. Okay. Murder Incorporated. Is that a classic American film noir or unless no Bruce Springsteen
These are
song?
These are great. That's another film. I swear to God, that's a film. I don't think that's a Murder Incorporated. No, I don't. That sounds like a movie title.
No, it's a Bruce Springsteen song.
Okay.
It was tacked on the great hits made in 1982. Strangers on a Train. Strangers on a Train. Is that a classic American film noir or a lesser-known Bruce Springsteen song?
You see, I don't see the industrial backdrop of Gary, Indiana, belching some fumes into the air. I see Bruce Springsteen. I'm sorry. Am I right?
No. It's a Hitchcock film, actually. A psychopath forces a tennis star to comply with his theory that two strangers can get away with a murder.
Really? Okay. Good. These are really good. Fantastic.
Moving on. Wages of Sin. Is that a classic American film noir or a lesser-known Bruce Springsteen song?
Yeah, I've got a strong feeling that it's Bruce Springsteen, but I mean, I ought to know this, but that's what I'm guessing.
It's a Bruce Springsteen song that was on the Tracks box set in 1998.
But you can hear that voice, can't you? The trailer, Wages of Sin.
So here we check in, but
they never check out.
Is this a classic American film noir or a lesser-known Bruce Springsteen song? Pick up on South Street. Pick up on South Street.
Oh, God, it sounds so Bruce Springsteen. That's precisely the kind of thing his 20-year-old imagination would have been rattling with, I would have thought. But then we haven't had very many. I'm going to say Springsteen again, but I'm probably wrong.
It's a 1953 film in which a pickpocket unwittingly lifts a message destined for enemy agents and becomes a target for a communist spying. Kiss Me Deadly. Is that a classic American film noir or a lesser-known Bruce Springsteen?
Film noir.
It is, 1953. A doomed female hitchhiker pulls Mike Hammer into a deadly whirlpool of intrigue.
You'd see it, though, wouldn't you?
You would.
God.
You would.
Pass the toffees. I'm in.
Thundercrack.
Well, anything with thunder in it has got to be Bruce Springsteen, sure.
It is.
I mean, that's a bit of a Springsteen riff, isn't it? That's great.
Okay. And finally, The Sweet Smell of Success. Is that a classic American film noir?
Well, it doesn't sound like a film noir title somehow, because it doesn't sound gloomy and complicated and grisly enough. So I'm going for Bruce.
No, it's a film. It's a great film, actually. It tells the story of a powerful and sleazy newspaper columnist who uses his connections to ruin his sister's relationship with a man he deems unworthy of her.
Very good. I love those descriptions.
That's a
genius one. Really inspired. Fantastic. So come on. We're even.
Yeah, we are even.
Good work.
Honours are definitely even. So, I've been watching. What does she call it?
Fran Lebowitz.
Pretend it's a City.
I've been watching it too.
Series of half-hour little films on Netflix, directed by Martin Scorsese, Fran Lebowitz, the great American New York columnist, kind of public speaker, really. I think is probably what she does as much as anything else. And it's just it's loads of shots from New York, isn't it? Loving shots from New York, and loads of really good music, and her being very kind of pungent in her points she makes about how people live in the city, used to live in the city nowadays. And I tell you one thing that struck me: there's loads of old clips, obviously, and. And they want to have the New York Dolls in it, don't they? And so these are two great figures of New York, Martin Scorsese and Fran Lebowitz, and they want to celebrate the New York Dolls. Where do they get the clip from, Mark?
I know. I thought it was so funny because the whole program is obviously it's about New York. It's about the and they're chosen because not just their name, they are the essence of New York.
Essence of New York.
The kind of they're deviant and they're radical and they're kind of they're outsiders. You know, and the clip comes from Old Grey Whistle Test.
It was shot at the Television Center.
Shepherd's Bush.
Probably continuity C, I think as they used to call it.
Yeah, that's right.
Up at the top of the place. Yeah. In Wood Lane, Shepherd's Bush.
I know.
So the only clip, clearly, the only clip of the New York Dolls must have been when they came over to Britain, which is pretty remarkable, really, isn't it?
There's stuff on YouTube from America, but it's just not very good quality, is it? I mean, that's studio sound and studio cameras, and
it's mimed, I think, really, but it's studio quality visuals.
Was it mimed? God, I haven't looked at it very carefully. Is that an Old Grey Whistle Test? They would.
I think early on they would have done. Early, I mean, if you go and see. I mean, very early, particularly when they're doing it in really small studios. I may be wrong about that one, but if you look at like the early clips of the first Wailers thing that they did at Whistle Test, I think that was mine. It certainly sounds like it. But anyway, I may be wrong about that. But it was. I just thought that was intriguing, the idea that the only bit that they had in the New York Dolls came from Wood Lane. Wood Lane, Shepherd's Bush, but I did enjoy it. I do like her a lot. I think she's
fantastic, actually. Because it's all it is it's seven episodes, isn't it? And it's just her walking around New York and pontificating about New York City. She's either out in the street, or it's old clips you say of her, being interviewed, or whatever. Or Scorsese sitting in a club talking to her. And what interests me is what is it about New York that's so different from anywhere else? Because everything about New York City seems to be kind of radical and on the edge and of huge cultural significance and ahead of the curve, and there's no real equivalent anywhere in the world. There couldn't be it's like the New Yorker magazine. You read Talk of the Town, and there's little sections about overheard picking up the kids from school in Greenwich Village, and everything seems to be so hip and forward thinking, and there's no equivalent of that. You couldn't have a magazine called The Londoner, because London doesn't have that character, does it? Doesn't represent the same kind of thing.
Not.
I mean, London's a great sprawling geographical area. And actually, New York City is really only 2 square miles going from around kind of Greenwich Village just up beyond the park, isn't it? So I thought it was interesting. And she talks about, she doesn't try to be funny just by being flip and surreal or taking a stand that she doesn't really believe in. She's just down, it's down to earth wisdom, isn't it? You know, that stuff about, her subway stations being done up, being closed for 5 months to be repaired. Whereas the subway itself doesn't really work, but the subway, because they're putting an art installation in there. this is what we need. Now public transport would be better. We're going to have some art installations in the station, But the sun loungers in Times Square. But she's great, I think. She's really good.
And she talks about... talks a lot about music, doesn't she? She was a friend of Charles Mingus, and gets a little pleasure from music. And she says that of all the arts, music is the one that makes people happiest. And which I was really interested.
Well, and she made a really good point. She says it most things that make you happy are bad for you. And music isn't. It's one of those few things that makes you happy and is really good for you. That's quite an interesting point, actually.
Yeah.
Well, it's wonderful, the stuff about Mingus. This is a bit where she goes to a Mingus show and he sees her. They've had an argument. He sees her in the audience and jumps off stage and pursues her down 20 blocks down the street, running after her. And eventually, they're both so exhausted, they kind of collapse. There's a silence as they sit there kind of puffing and panting. And he goes, "Hey, do you want to eat?" She goes, "You're meant to be on stage. People are paying
to see you."
There's
a load of people back there waiting for you to finish it.
Absolutely brilliant. And there's a lovely bit. I mean, talk about the high caliber name she drops. At one point, she says she has, how old is she now? She's about 70, I think. She has Duke Ellington and Charles Mingus.
Charles Mingus.
You think that's something else, isn't it? Incredible. But no, a lot about music.
If you were having breakfast with Ellington and Mingus, you'd just be sitting there getting on with your toast, wouldn't you, really? You wouldn't attempt to contribute, would you, really?
She made a really interesting point about Charles Mingus, that Charles Mingus was very arrogant, huge ego, really kind of massive sense of self-importance. But in the company of Duke Ellington, he was meek, mild, wasn't he, subservient? Completely deferential.
Don't you think? Doesn't that always happen with musicians? That musicians really quickly detect the pecking order.
Yeah.
You know, if there's somebody in the room who's more prestigious than they are, they slightly shut up.
Yeah.
Because they know that. You know what I mean? It's like we often say there's, you know, that if you have a room full of rock legends and then you introduce Bob Dylan. Everybody else just steps back a little bit, don't they?
In fact, happened in the Travelling Wilburys. There's no doubt about it. When you see the footage of the Travelling Wilburys, you know, and that's the group that's got Roy Orbison in it, for God's sake. But when Dylan says or does anything, they're all George Harrison completely in awe of it. It's really sweet. It's George Harrison's band, really. No, absolutely true. It's fascinating, man. Fascinating.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Okay, we're back and joined by Alex Gold, as usual, and as unusual, Sam Pope. Thank you very much for being with us, gentlemen. Now, most podcasts are very keen to tell you that they got their finger on the pulse. I'm very keen to tell you that I don't have my finger on the pulse at all, but I'm dimly aware that within the last week, everybody's been talking about sea shanties, okay? And so Sam and Alex, between you, can tell me about what's been going on with sea shanties over the last week. Because, Sam, you've done one, haven't you? Tell us about this.
Yeah, so I don't know quite why, but they are becoming quite a trend at the moment. and particularly on the app TikTok. They've completely blown up, and there's been a lot of quite a few people that whose accounts have grown massively just over the past maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and myself included. Luckily, I just literally posted one TikTok sea shanty of an Alan Doyle song from the Robin Hood film called "Row Me Bully Boys Row." And a huge amount. I think it ended up with over 1 million streams, and I think it was something like 4,000 or 5,000 people have duetted with the video, which is a feature you can do on TikTok where you literally just add another video on top of the last one and try and contribute something to it.
Didn't it start with a guy called Nathan Evans, a Scottish postman? Right. There's a group called the Longest Johns in Bristol who've had a lot of success. But Nathan Evans started it, didn't he?
That's right.
He's a folk musician. He just recorded one sea shanty last summer, I think, and it suddenly took off from there.
He did the Wellerman, and he recorded. I mean, he's fantastic. Like he recorded very well, and then the duet feature just kind of ran away with it, and there's all these videos of I don't know if you've ever seen it, but when you the original video starts on the side of the screen, and then you add the next one and the next one, and it's almost like one of those mirror effects where you can just see it disappearing off into the distance. And it's astonishing the amount of people that got involved with that trend. But it's blown up to the point where I think he's been on news programs and the radio, and is releasing an album and all sorts of things off the back of just one song, which is incredible.
But what's your theory as to why those have just sort of caught the public imagination then?
I think there's a couple that I've come across. I think that there's been a release of a couple of Viking style games recently, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, which is very popular. There's a series called Vikings. The last episode of the last season was the end of last year in December. I think that's probably played a part in popular culture. But also, I feel more importantly, it's the nature of sea shanties. I think sea shanties were written to help sailors go through these tedious journeys over long distances and stave off boredom. And I think that's pretty much exactly what the world is.
And they're also they're about group physical activity, aren't they? They're meant to accompany pulling in of ropes and rowing of whaling boats and stuff. So there's a sense of kind of community, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that, you know, not all sailors had beautiful voices, and the songs weren't written for people who have astonishing range. So they're meant for everyone to be able to sing. And I think the duet feature on TikTok has just run away with that completely, because absolutely everyone and anyone is contributing, which is fantastic. Like I've had so many comments on my videos saying, I've never done a TikTok duet, but I absolutely have to do this one. And it's amazing, because you get to go through and see people that wouldn't dare dream outside of their own shower suddenly deciding that they're going to film themselves and put it online for everyone to see, which is astonishing.
It's effectively community singing, isn't it?
By using
new technology.
Absolutely.
So tell me, when you first did it, you've presumably used TikTok before, and when you're doing things, I mean, you're an actor, a musician, you know, you're presumably doing things partly for your own amusement, but you're also thinking, well, one of these might get a bit of
absolutely.
A tickle.
I just never thought it would be sea shanties.
So is this, you've done things on TikTok before, but this is the biggest one, presumably.
Mm, absolutely, yeah. Okay. I mean, I've been on for about 3 months.
Did you rehearse it? First of all, this is what intrigues me with this stuff. Yeah. When I look at it, I think, my God, I don't have the brain, let alone the skills, to do that kind of thing. Are the people who do these things, are they doing them first and then throwing them away and saying, no, I can do it better. No, I can do it better. Or are they just putting it out there?
I don't know. I mean, I can only speak from personal experience. I think for me, I've been on the app for about 3 months, maybe four. And the first set of videos I was doing, I was just doing little videos, duetting other people's stuff and just contributing and adding vocal lines or little comedy skits or whatever. And then I started trying to figure out how to use editing software and music software. So I started playing around a bit and doing some covers and playing instruments and editing it all together and all this kind of stuff, and spending a lot of time doing it, and maybe spending 3 or 4 days editing one video to post.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So that was, but that was partly for my own sake as well. You know, it wasn't so much. It was a learning curve. But particularly when I got to the sea shanty stuff, they're such simple videos to be able to create now. Like, you don't have to have a lot of equipment or put a lot of time in. And I think I set up one camera. I have my condenser microphone that I have set up next to the camera. I've bought a drum kit recently as well that I've now got in my little studio space. So I put that next to my desk. I've got the kick drum, and I literally use the kick drum to keep beat and sing the melody straight into the camera, record it all through one mic, and then put it into Logic and layer on some harmonies and chorus work on top of it, which relatively I can get, I think, about 3 or 4 shanties done in one evening if I so chose.
3 or 4 shanties a night.
Mental. Yeah. It's crazy compared to the old work rate. I think people in general, the thing about the app, about TikTok in particular, is that it's not so much about having a polished article. There are people out there that put out content that they spend hours and hours and hours creating. But there's also people that on the spur of the moment just pick up their phone, film something because they think it's funny, or film something of them singing or whatever, and then upload it straight away. And I think it's great to see the mix of content where you have some really captivating footage that someone's edited together and really well shot and well lit and everything, and then the next video will be just as if I'm holding my phone now filming myself around my house, yeah, and someone showing you something funny their dog did. So it is a great, you know, a great way of seeing a whole mix of content.
So what will you be doing next, or don't you know?
Well, right now I'm gonna ride this wave, pardon the pun, of sea shanties. And I think the next one I'm going to do, I've been working on doing some pop or modern songs and turning them into sea shanty form.
You've done that. You've done an Eminem song, haven't you?
I did,
sea shanty version. It's great.
Yes, yeah, so I did Lose Yourself by Eminem.
Yeah. So what are you planning to do next then?
Well, I just really, I literally yesterday just posted the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air rap as a sea shanty. So that one seems to be doing quite well. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. And I've got a couple of people have asked me to write a Star Wars shanty as well. Nice. So I might look into that, particularly because this is another thing that started off as just casual and a little bit of a joke. I started starting all my videos saying hello there, but saying it as Ewan McGregor says it in one of the first Star Wars films. It's because that's quite a popular meme on TikTok in particular. So I just go, hello there. And that's the beginning of every one of my videos now. And I'm getting constant comments saying, oh, General Kenobi or General Grievous, all these quotes from Star Wars. So I feel like I probably have to do that one at some point. So maybe that's the next one I'll work on.
Well, you know, all the very best with it. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us.
And it's a pleasure.
Shining some light in my darkness.
An education.
Mark Allen knew all about it. I didn't. Sam Pope, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks very much for having me.
Round of applause. Zoom radio style. Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
I've got we've had a very nice bit of press, haven't we? From GQ, from the GQ website.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Why Word in Your Ear is the best music podcast on the internet, which is, you know, harsh but fair. And and I tweeted this. I'm not going to hide our light under a bushel. Why should we? And I've been delighted by some of the responses. Somebody said, I'm reading this for you. I drive a lorry for a living and find music radio is very little for me. I devour audiobooks and podcasts, and yours is the one I look forward to the most. And what I thought you'd like is nom de Twitter of this person who drives lorries for a living is Percy Filth. Percy Filth.
Again, three more from them. Yeah,
absolutely.
That's great.
Three more from them after the news. What was it you were telling me about Danny Boyle, Mark?
Oh, well, Danny Boyle, I mean, that just really interests me because the success of Rocket Man and Bohemian Rhapsody has started a gold rush in rock biopics, because they were huge, hugely successful films. And so now there's obviously a big rush on to get out the next lot of biopics. And there have been two on Sex Pistols already. There was The Filth and the Fury, wasn't there? There was a Sid and Nancy, which did quite well. But Danny Boyle, he's about to start shooting. He's casting about to start shooting a film version of the story of the Sex Pistols, which I think will do really well. It just made me think there are so many. I mean, there have been quite a few biopics already, but there are so many haven't been made. Nobody's made one about Fleetwood Mac yet. Why not? Wouldn't that be great? Fleetwood Mac, the love pentangle. Well, I mean, it'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? Blondie. I mean, what a story.
Can I just say, I just push against this slightly.
Go on.
Which is that most band stories have unhappy endings, and films crave happy endings. So if you leave people with a downbeat ending, that's not why people buy tickets to go to the cinema.
Fleetwood Mac's got a happy ending. Blondie's got a happy ending. Ramones, maybe not so.
Sex Pistols, certainly not so.
Hasn't there? I'm sure there's been a Keith Moon.
No, you can end with the reunion of the Sex Pistols. I think Sex Pistols is a good story. Surviving Sex Pistols are all having reasonably good lives. They got together. They did their kind of, you know, their whatever it's called, contraction. Filthy, what was it called? The Filthy Liquor. I can't remember.
Yeah, Filthy Luca.
Yeah, Luca, the Filthy Luca tour, yeah. No, I mean, I think a lot of them have got great endings, you know. And you can engineer a happy ending. Fleetwood Mac, I mean, that's a great story. There's been a few people dropped by the wayside, but I mean, yes, otherwise it's just a hilarious.
Bit, just a bit. it's laughs all the way.
Yeah,
apart from the many deaths and so forth.
But Blondie, honestly, you think of the events that happened in Blondie's life. The Hall of Fame in 2006, if I remember rightly, Frank Infant and Nigel Harrison and Gary Valentine all turned up, and they weren't really members of the band, but they were invited by the Hall of Fame anyway to see the group get the recognition, and they were going to play, the band were going to play. And then they came up and tried to get on stage and asked to come on stage and play with the band in publicly in front of all those people, televised. I mean, that's just an epic piece of film making waiting to happen, isn't it? It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Ramones, I mean, I know the Ramones doesn't have a terribly happy ending, but what an incredible story. We need to know that. You know, one of them, I think it was Joey, stole Johnny's girlfriend, didn't he, 20 years before the end of the group, and that they barely spoke to each other ever again. You know, they would travel to gigs and you know, and they never made enough money that they could live the luxury of being able to travel in separate vehicles and be in different hotels and avoid each other apart from being on stage. They had to kind of just rub along together for 20 years after all this friction. It's fantastic.
Dee Dee's a film in himself as well.
What's that?
I thought Dee Dee Ramone would be a film in himself.
Yes, he would. Yeah. Well, I mean,
I think there's been a Keith Moon film in development for, God, it must be about a decade. Mike Myers is meant to be involved. And I keep seeing references to its production or pre-production in various papers.
See, that will not happen right at this moment. I mean, I don't mean the pandemic moment, but celebrating Keith Moon as a hero, knowing what we know about Keith Moon, it's a very difficult sell. Very difficult.
It is.
It's more, you know, a lot of things he did were really unpleasant. You know, fantastic drummer. The group would not have been the group without him. But, you know, that's not what biopics are about, is it?
No.
They're about celebrating heroes, you know.
Well, all right, here's some others. Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart biopic. Why not? Led Zeppelin. It would work. The Who, possibly. The Who.
It would be great,
yeah. Deep Purple. I mean, these are all fantastic stories.
Can I throw in a
reasonably happy endings? You can engineer a happy ending.
Can I throw in a sweeping statement, which I'll ask for Alex to either confirm or deny based on his experience of being a band? You talk about the Ramones being exceptional because one member slept with another member's girlfriend, wife, whatever. I'm saying not exceptional at all. I'm saying pretty much all groups, one member steals another member's partner.
Oh, I think so. It was the end of Japan, wasn't it? Wasn't it Japan? Was it?
Was it really?
Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty frequent. But if you think about the environments most bands form themselves in, most of them are, you know, pretty frequently in a state where they don't really know what they're doing. So, and this makes situations like that eminently more possible. So, yeah, it's kind of, maybe not so much now, because I think musicians, The generation below me of musicians are generally more rounded people, a lot younger. But certainly when I were a lad, it was pretty normal for a little bit of swappage and all that.
But also, if you're in a band and you're touring, you're in that little bubble where you only ever get to socialise with or get to know or spend any amount of time with a very, very select number of people.
Yeah,
so that's where, you know, that's why... You know, if it isn't too much of a cliche or a generalization, but I think it's true, it's why most women in bands who front bands tended to have relationships with people in those bands, because they kind of felt safe with these are the people they got to know and travel with and were on the tour bus, you know.
But also, there's the mentality of survival as well, I think, because, you know, most bands are poor. And, you know, when you're poor, you sort of take what you can get when you can get it. You know, and this applies to eating, washing. You know, if you think that someone might fancy you, my God, you're going to go for it while you know that window of opportunity is open, because you don't know when the next one might be. You know, it's that kind of mentality.
like your attitude to food, isn't it, Alex, on tour? if food is presented, eat it, because you never know.
All musicians do that. It's like, you don't know when the next meal's coming. It's just a massive meal.
You always end up starving, you know, an 8-pack of BrewDog or whatever it is, because you don't know when the next time you go to get some beers in, you know.
Relating all this to somebody we talked to this week, I still insist, going back to the stories of bands, the Beatles is the best story of bands.
Yes.
It, because it starts and it finishes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't finish too unhappily, really. I mean, I know there's a certain amount of bitterness there, but it's all triumph. They never declined. They never had to come back or anything like that.
Can I just interject and confess that at the end of the anthology, when Ringo says, you know, at the end of the day, we were just four guys who loved one another, I shed a little tear.
Yeah. Well,
ashamed of.
Nothing to be ashamed of at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, perfect story.
And so we're talking to Tom Holland this week in Word in Your Attic about he wants to write a history book, doesn't he, about where the Beatles fit into this, to all this, in the history of kind of Western thought and Western.
He was so interesting about it. The thing about really talking about the Beatles in the shadow of the Second World War was so interesting, because you know he was saying how radical their message, the kind of all you need is love message, was, because they were born during the war. They, you know, there's that they, on the way to Hamburg, they stopped, didn't they, with Lord Woodbine and visited the War Memorial. You know, they just grew up with the shadow, John Winston Lennon, you know, the whole thing, and the fact that they were writing that those songs that. About a kind of unifying love after all that had a real significance at the time, which we probably don't appreciate now. Another thing Tom Holland said is he started the song every day, didn't he, Dave, by playing two particular songs. He played Good Day Sunshine and Here Comes the Sun, because he said the value of happy music was so crucial at the moment. I thought it was really interesting. I went and put on Good Day Sunshine after that, and it made me think what a fantastic lyricist McCartney is. We take a walk, the sun is shining down, burns my feet as they touch the ground. It's just, that's a great lyric, isn't it? What do you think? Just thrown away. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Brilliant song.
And oddly enough, he's the man with bare feet on the cover of Abbey Road, isn't he?
Yeah.
Never thought about that. Burns.
But I remember doing we did a piece in Word about songwriters. And one of the things that I asked various people was, is it more difficult to write a happy song than a sad song? And K.D. Lang said, as a society, we have trained ourselves to think that melancholy produces better art. And that was a really good point. And it extends to everything. It's exactly the same as the Oscars. You know, is it easier to get an Oscar for Bridesmaids or for My Left Foot? You know, the answer is obviously My Left Foot, you know, because any film about suffering or sorrow or melancholy or... you know, or any kind of internal navigation is considered to be more substantial and more worthwhile than anything that's just funny. I mean, how many comedians got Oscars? Did Steve Martin ever get one? No, he had one of those specially invented Oscars. He never got an Oscar for any of the films he was in.
In terms of writing, though, you know, aren't the emotions we see as negative, aren't they more strongly felt? So is it not easier to come up with something that's a little bit yearning or melancholy than it is to come up with something happy, which maybe doesn't give writers the same push?
No, I think that's absolutely true. And also, I think you could argue that part of the appeal of music a lot of the time is it's something you listen to on your own. It's a solitary thing. You don't necessarily listen to music en masse or particularly these days, with people in you know, a large number of people in a room. You're listening to it on your own, and therefore it's about solitary experience, which tends to be more melancholy. It is about
solitary listening. I did my latest album from Dave's book list last night.
Oh, right, go on. Where are you? Where are you this week?
For the very first time, I listened to the Kinks' Something Else.
All right. All right.
And two things I took away.
Good record. Go on.
How absolutely underrated Ray Davies' voice is. It's when you zone in on it, it's really super expressive. And I remember when I was a child, actually, I heard You Really Got Me for the first time, and there was something about the way he sung it which really, really appealed to me. There was just something in the tone and the delivery of his voice that just, it just sounded interesting, even to like an 8-year-old who knew nothing about music and didn't really care, you know. But listening to, you know, Waterloo Sunset as a grown up and listening to his voice, he just, obviously the, you know, he's one of the great lyricists, but the way he delivers those stories could not be delivered by anybody else. He's got one of the great, great British voices, I think. And it's not sung enough. But also how shoddy some of the playing was and how a good mix can really sort that out, because some of it's so sloppy. I mean, again, what
by is, which member of the group, who are we calling into question here?
Pete Quaife is a little bit either side of the beat. And it sometimes the bass lines sound a little bit like he's just sort of catching up with himself. But Dave Davies is really sloppy. Actually, and Ray was no great shakes as a guitarist, let's face it. So basically, they're all...
Nobody looks to the Kinks, though, for instrumental prowess, do they? They just they're just about songs and stories, you know, beautifully told.
They are, but looking at it from a musical point of view, you kind of expect all great bands' records to be robustly put together. But actually, you know, what you don't realise is a lot of the playing on those records is pretty sloppy.
Yeah.
And the way they're mixed and the way they're produced. Obviously, the songs, you know, the songs being strong really helps. But it's easy to overlook
a Kinks record in those days would have been put together in a week, I would have thought.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really fast.
Well, Ray Davies talks about the pressure they were under, just being a hit machine and just having to, they had to, like the Beatles, you know, except the Beatles somehow did it in slightly more relaxed fashion. You know, literally, you wrote in your diary, Tuesday, write a hit, Wednesday, record it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Friday, write another one.
Wasn't Please Please Me, the album, recorded in an afternoon?
It was done in 12 hours, I think, 10 hours, 12 hours. One day. So great, happy songs. Tightrope by Janelle Monáe. Good Vibrations. I Get Around. Ichiku Park. Wouldn't it be nice? Here's a great one. Or California Dreaming. But here's a great one. Daydream by The Loving Spoonful. What is wrong with that song? Nothing.
Daydream, Believer by The Monkees.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Happy by Pharrell.
Happy by Pharrell. Yeah, it's a bit of a giveaway in the title. But, they're at a premium at the moment. They really are.
I tell you what, it's a bit of a cliche, but... because there was a period of time when it seemed to be used as incidental music on the television absolutely all the time. But for me, it never lost its appeal, is U2's Beautiful Day.
Oh, right,
actually.
It's a fantastic explosion of happiness. Yeah, Walking on Sunshine is the same thing.
It's Walking on Sunshine, very much so, yeah.
It's instant happiness, you know.
Lulu's version of Shout.
Going back to the happiness thing, I tell you where this is most interesting to me, is in comedy nowadays. Now, there used to be a time when if you wanted to be a comedian, you started at the age of about 12 and then you went to the halls and you served your apprenticeship and so forth. Nowadays, if you want to be a comedian, you go to university first. And you know, because that's the way to approach comedy. And so comedians as a breed nowadays take themselves fantastically seriously.
Yeah, they do.
And one of the ways that they justify doing what they do for a living is claiming that what they do has some element of kind of social criticism about it, that they think the job of comedy is to confront ideas and to sort of upset people and to be provocative. No, it's not. The job of comedy is really, really simple. Make me laugh. Now, it may do all those other things as well, but if it doesn't make me laugh, it's not comedy. And so if you watch Morecambe and Wise, you know, their old clips on YouTube, there's no social criticism there whatsoever. It's not about anything but itself. It's not about anything but just the delight in being funny. And that's all part of the same argument, it seems to me, that and it sort of happened with rock bands, that once rock bands started going to university, they then had to tell you that what they did was not just fun, it was important, because they were burdened with this idea that they had to suffer for their art. You know what
it's
I mean?
Absolutely, now it's your true. Turn. It's completely true. There are comedians like Lee Mack who never get any credit at all, who are genuinely funny, very, very witty and spontaneous guy. Never gets any credit because all his stuff is kind of considered to be superficial. He doesn't represent anything. I think that's absolutely right. Now, to be a successful comedian, you've got to be, you're being funny about some complicated about social something. Issue or whatever. It's an issue that you, that's what I do. I look at this and I somehow get some humour out of it, you know. Also, the other thing about comedians, I think, is it's so difficult being labelled. A comedian, I was reading an interview with Richard Osman, the quiz master and now very successful novelist, the other day, and he was saying that he never calls himself a comedian because he says, if I go on panel shows, and then I say something funny, people think, well, that's great. This guy said something funny. But if you're a comedian, he's not a comedian. He's not billed as a comedian. But if you're billed as a comedian, you're the pressure to be funny. It's like that idea, have you ever met somebody at a party who says, well, you say, well, I'm a comedian. And you kind of think, well, that's so different from saying I'm a musician. Because if I'm a musician, they don't have to prove then and there that they're a successful one. Because the definition of a comedian is somebody who, as you say, makes somebody laugh. You're looking at them thinking, are you? Are you really? You know, must be miserable.
Yeah, it must be horrible. Well, that's why none of us will ever be comedians. So what else is happening in the word in your ear and word in your attic? Alex, we've just done Andy Miller this week. We did Tom Holland this week. Remind me. Go on.
We did Graham Goldman of Tennessee.
Yeah, of course. Of
he
course.
Was terrific.
The great Graham Goldman.
Oh, he was fantastic.
We got more of that stuff coming up over the next few weeks. The quiz goes from strength to strength, doesn't it? Now incorporating not just visual clues, but also audio clues. And so that takes place every Friday evening at 6 o'clock. It's an ideal ending to the week. And so if you haven't taken part in it, do take part in it in the future. If you want to take part in it, that's open to Patreon supporters. And if you want to know at what level you might like to get involved as a Patreon supporter, if you go to patreon.com/wordinyourear, we might even be in time to celebrate your birthday by shinning down the digital chimney, shinning down the digital drain pipe, and providing a bit of a word in your attic in your own personal
service. Absolutely.
Personal service, which we extend to you. Yes, so if you hadn't already looked into that, do so. Sorry, Alex, carry on.
We have some new patrons, actually.
Good.
I'd like to welcome Sam Hollingsworth.
Very good.
Welcome aboard, Sam Hollingsworth.
Mark Osborne.
Terrific.
Mark Osborne, nice to have you.
Kevin Rose.
Good man.
Kevin, I thought you were about to say Kevin Rowland for a second. Kevin Rose, okay.
Andy Parker.
I thought you were going to say Andy Partridge.
Andy Parker. Yeah, we're particularly with you.
Open to people whose names sound a little bit like pop stars in the 1980s.
Nicholas Davidson.
Nicholas Davidson.
Good to have him.
Paul Knox. And Emerson Rogers.
And Emerson, what a great name.
Emerson Rogers is like a president of the United States in the 18th century. Very good.
Okay.
We should also mention that we're plotting a Patreon only gathering, aren't we, for the next couple of weeks?
We are.
Oh, we are.
With more details of that in the next few days. So make sure you investigate at patreon.com/wordinyourear. And welcome on board.
Hello there, here's another shanty rap. Now this is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. I'll take just a minute, boys, sit ye right there. I'll tell ye the tale of the Prince of Bel-Air.
Row, boys, yo, boys.
A story with characters rare.
Row, boys, yo, boys. The tale of the Prince of Bel-Air.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised, the playground is where I spend most of my days. Just chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool.
Shooting some b-ball outside of the school.
When a couple of fellas, both up to no good, start to make trouble in my neighborhood. Got in one little fight, and my mother got scared. Said,
you'll move with your uncle and aunt in Bel-Air. Now row, boys, yo, boys, a story with characters rare.
Oh, row, boys, yo, boys.
is the tale of the Prince of Bel-Air.